Yeah, so there's something in this quote, it's a long quote, I won't quote it all, and something in this picture that speaks to me very deeply. And I think what this picture is doing, what this quote is doing, it's pointing to a deeper meaning of the spiritual life, so a deeper meaning of our quest in life. And often when I sit and look at this picture on my the picture of the Bodhisattva on my solitary retreats, lots of thoughts go around in my head. And I also wonder, does this mean that the Bodhisattva is also paying reverence to the Sangha, to the spiritual community? Because the Buddha himself is an embodiment of Sangha. The Buddha himself is an experience of Sangha. And then on the international convention in India in February, I think, this year, Subhuti gave a talk, and it was called Revering and Relying on the Sangha. And this talk was very important to me. I've listened to it quite a few times. It's also available on Free Buddhist Audio. And in the course of this talk, Subhuti has, discovered that the Buddha, I won't go into all the ins and outs of the talk, but Subhuti discovered that the Buddha, in the scriptures, the Buddha actually said, "Once the Sangha attained to greatness, I lived revering and relying on the Sangha." So once the Sangha came to greatness, I lived reverencing and relying on the Sangha. And I think we could have a whole talk on what that means. And what does it mean by this word greatness, when the Sangha came to greatness? And I don't think this talk can in any way adequately cover that quote. But it's about committed individuals coming together. That greatness is about committed individuals coming together. And it's about the Arya Sangha, which I think some of you or most of you will have heard about. It's about the spirit of Sangha. And it's also about something that's interpersonal. It's not just about me, it's interpersonal. So the Buddha lived reverencing, revering and relying on the Sangha. And then I think about Bhante Sangharakshita. Bhante himself said that he wasn't really suited to building a Sangha. He just wasn't really, he didn't really have the right sort of character or personality to build a Sangha. But he did it. And the fact that we're sitting here is a result of his work. So Bhante actually built Sangha. And it's something that we, all of us here, I'm sure, really treasure. The fact that we can come together, that we can practice together. And I think it's a quality that really sets Sri Ratna apart from many other Buddhist schools or Buddhist movements. And it's something that other spiritual communities are intrigued by, the fact that it works. that it works in Sri Ratna. And I think other spiritual communities are quite fascinated by the fact that Sangha is our A and O. Yeah? A and O, is that okay? Alpha and Omega. Sangha is the A and O of Sri Ratna. So, moving on and thinking about myth, I came up with this idea of what myth could be. So it's not a definition, and I've used aloka quite a bit. So I'm talking about myth here as a truly creative symbolic pattern of meaning, which has both individual and collective dimensions. So a truly creative symbolic pattern of meaning, which has both individual and collective dimensions. And it's engaging with myth that develops and matures our whole being. So I thought that I would, at this point, just read a little bit from this quote. So, Alokya says, "To experience oneself as creatively engaged within an intelligent and meaningful context that addresses one's whole being is to be leading a truly human existence. It is only within such a context that one can develop the strength and flexibility of mind necessary to penetrate to the very core of that existence and begin to realize one's full creative potential." Shall I read it again? Is it worth it? Yes, I think it's worth reading it again, actually. "To experience oneself as creatively engaged within an intelligent and meaningful context that addresses one's whole being is to be leading a truly human existence. It is only within such a context that one can develop the strength and flexibility of mind necessary to penetrate to the very core of that existence and begin to realize one's full creative potential." So I just find this very, very exciting. I'm not sure I actually really understand it. I can't pretend that I fully understand it, but I just find it really exciting to keep going back to time and time again. So in this talk, I'm going to use quotes from Alokya. I'm going to use Subhuti, things that he said in this talk in India. And I'm going to use another order member, a talk that I listened to, and that's Atala. Some of you might have come across Atala. He's been ordained, I don't know, 35 years, a long, long time. And he's been working about 20 years as a psychotherapist. And again, you can listen to a really good talk called Mending a Broken Ladder, where I've got a lot of these ideas from. So myth in the spiritual life is engaging in a context or in patterns, in symbols, which lead to integration. So I use this word rather carefully because we have lots of different ideas about what integration is. And I hope it will become, because I'm not going to use this word, I don't think, again. I'm going to use other words to try and describe it. But I'm trying to keep shorthand here. So it leads to integration. So myth helps us to move from where we are in our human messiness, in our human dilemma, in our inner conflicts, in our brokenness. This is a word Atala uses. In our brokenness, in our separation. It helps us to move from all of those things towards our ideals and aspirations. So the spiritual community as a myth has this individual and collective dimension. It's very hard to separate, that they go hand in hand. But you could say, on a simplistic level, that the spiritual community acts as an integrating force on an individual level. Through our association with others in the spiritual community, we get to know ourselves. We're engaging with others. We're beginning to heal this sense of brokenness, this sense of separation. And we start to move together towards our ideals. And the spiritual community is the context in which we live out those ideals. And collectively, we're working on spiritual will. So transcending ego perspective, transcending ego identity. Transcending individualistic will. And I don't think there's any better myth, if you like, or story or parable or symbol or allegory for that than the story of the Aniruddhas, which I think most of you will know, the three Aniruddhas. So the three Aniruddhas is spiritual community at its best, at its greatest. And I remember when I was living, going back quite a few years now, I was living in Taraloka. This is a retreat centre for women in Wales. And one of the oldest members of that community is an order member called Ratnasuri. I think she's about 90 now. I think she's just had her 90th birthday. Still living there in the community. And we had this, it was sort of a joke, but we actually meant it seriously. We decided we would work together with Ratnasuri so that she would become a stream entrant. So we thought we'd really somehow find the conditions, because that's what it needs, find the conditions so that Ratnasuri could become a stream entrant. And we were, you know, we were joking, but we were also serious. And we realised, stream entrant okay, yeah? We realised, actually, that if we were really building conditions so that Ratnasuri could become a stream entrant, we would also become stream entrants too, yeah? And I think, again, that's what spiritual community is doing, yeah? We're helping people on, but in helping people on, we're actually helping ourselves. So when we think about our own lives, and if I think about my life, I begin to see a lot of myths played out. And I noticed, as I was sort of reflecting on my own myths, that the senses, the five senses, seem to dominate. So, you know, there's the myth of the glass of red wine. There's the myth of the cigarette. Not that I smoke, not that I drink very much red wine, but there's the myth there. There's the myth of the high-heeled red shoes. Yeah? There's the myth of the sunset, the myth of romance, the myth of blue sea and white beaches, the country cottage and the honeysuckle. Yeah? Think of your daydreams. Yeah? Just think of your daydreams. What myths are played out there? And I mean, I don't know if you've got any examples of other things. That's what I came up with, but I'm sure there's lots and lots of other examples. There's the rituals we do. There's myth in there. There's our habits. You know, what we're doing is we're investing in something to try and get that sense of wholeness, to try and get that sense of being fully alive. And, you know, the myth of the glass of the red wine, for me, the myth is relaxation, yeah, enjoyment, reward, yeah, that's the myth that's being played out there. So Attila says that in science, in Christianity, in consumerism, or from those sources, we are constantly confronted with different myths. And these myths have power over us. And because they have power over us, we're not conscious of what they're doing to us. And because everybody else is just doing it and also staying unconscious to that power, we don't understand actually what's happening to us. We don't bother to investigate these things. And I think that in the 21st century, there's a whole list, there's a whole realm of myth that we're fed, which we're very unconsciously absorbing it. And then there's the myths which we perpetuate when we talk about ourselves. The stories we tell about ourselves, or the papancha, the things that obsess us, yeah, that we keep repeating about ourselves. And the way that we try to establish and impose meaning and a pattern on our experience. We try and control it. So what myths are being played out there? So Aloka says that when these myths are operating on an unconscious level, they're motivated by self-interest. We have a very narrow frame of reference. And it's quite dangerous because there's power there that we're not investigating. And he talks about how often we are, there's the myth of the nice ideas. You know, many people get involved in Buddhism and they find the ideas quite nice. or conventional morality. But Aloka says, if that's just the level of our myth, there is no way that the forces of light can get in. So the spiritual life is moving away from our ego perspective. Atala has a whole list of words he uses to talk about ego perspective. He says, this is what holds us down, just seeing things from our perspective. And he talks about the tendencies of denial, oppressiveness, defensiveness, anxiety, sounds awful, anxiety, repression, self-view. And then he comes again with this word of brokenness, separation. And of course, as we know, that's all to do with dukkha. So yes, the spiritual life is moving away from those imprisonments and moving towards freedom and true creativity. So free of potentially restrictive views, restrictive systems. And this is a huge challenge. So how do we do this? So quoting Aloka again, he says, the myth is essential in terms of having a symbolic pattern which allows one a meaningful way to live with the insecurities of any truly creative process. So I'll read it again. The myth is essential in terms of having a symbolic pattern which allows one a meaningful way to live with the insecurities of any truly creative process. And if myth is just about the five senses, nice ideas and conventional morality, it doesn't address our existential insecurities. It can't help us break out into freedom. And not only that, there's no way that the Dharma can take root in our Western culture. So if you think about myths in Buddhism, and I'm sure all of you have come across some of these anyway. I'm thinking what comes to my mind are the five jinnas, yeah, the five Buddhas, yeah, in the mandala. I'm thinking about the Wheel of Life, which is up there. I'm thinking about the story of Avalokiteshvara and how his head split, yeah, and how his arms body split into 1,000 arms and 11 heads. I'm thinking about all the archetypes of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. And I remembered that when I was a Mitra, we had another refuge tree than the one that is now used. And that refuge tree had a Tibetan background. It had Padmasambhava in the middle. And I used to love that refuge tree because on the different lotus petals down from Padmasambhava, there were all sorts of spirits and sprites and hobgoblins and different sorts. They all had different, you know, names, Tibetan names or Sanskrit names. But there were all sorts of different beings, and all those different beings symbolized aspects of your psyche, yeah, aspects of your mind. And the idea was that's, you know, it's all those parts of our psyche we need to bring together so that they're also on their way to enlightenment. And I think in Swedish culture, you have something very similar, yeah? There's still that good old paganism running through Swedish culture, yeah? That's what we think, the good old paganism. We need to get back to that because there, people really did see themselves in relationship to the world, in relationship to their environment. We've lost that. So this is what, and this is what Attila's talking about in terms of separateness, brokenness. So integration is about bringing all those parts of our psyche together, bringing them together in a wholeness, acknowledging our brokenness, acknowledging our messiness, and finding a creative place, or finding our creative place in the scheme of things. And we need imagination for this engagement. And I thought, you know, when you, well, maybe not, because Dharmagiri is all, it's got a lovely shrine there, very beautiful shrine. But I don't know if those of you who've been involved longer remember going to cottages and all sorts of places for retreats where we would make these shrines. And we would make them with bits of old wood and orange boxes and cardboard boxes and nails and screws and all sorts of things. It looked dreadful. And then you threw a wonderful cloth over it, or several cloths over it, you'd ironed. And then you put the Buddha there, and you put some flowers there, and some candles, and some puja bowls, and some pictures. And then you'd have your retreat. And that shrine would become an absolute central part of your imagination, a central part of your aspiration, your ideals. You'd go up to it, you'd offer, you'd bow before it, you'd prostrate before it, and you'd invest something in that shrine. And not only would you invest something in it, it would speak back to you. It would reflect something back to you. And then at the end of the retreat, you had to throw it all away. And you'd just see what it was. Bits of wood, bits of cardboard, nails and screws and this and that. Yeah. And there was something magical about creating. And that's what myth is about. We're creating something. And then we're putting our whole being in it. And it's coming back to us. It's actually giving us back to ourselves. So Attila talks about giving the world back its life, giving ourselves back our lives, our internal world, our external world, our inner and outer experience. So when we just simply, when our myths are just simply to do with the everyday using our five senses to get something from the world in that way, it's a very strong individualistic tendency. And Attila talks a lot about soul. Yeah, I don't mean in the Christian sense, but he talks about it also as a sort of symbol of a wider sense of ourselves, a broader and deeper sense of ourselves connecting. So how can I come into relationship with the world? And how can I serve the world? If I'm just wanting out from the world, get from the world, that's individualistic. How can I serve the world? How can I find my place in the universe so that I'm serving and affecting the world? So the spiritual community and the Sangha, or the Sangha, as I've said, individually and collectively, brings actually myth into being. We engage with myth. We create patterns of meaning where our egos are brought into relationship with our ideals. And just think of all we do together in the Sangha, all we do to get to know ourselves in the spiritual community. We are coming into contact with people who are like us, people who are very different to us, people we don't like particularly, we don't feel particularly orientated, we find them a bit strange. There's all sorts of differences we meet in the Sangha. And we see ourselves reflected back, oh, right. Yeah. We get to know ourselves, we get to know our egos, we get to know our ego perspectives. We also get to know our shadow sides, the things that we find hard to own, the things we exile, we push away. We get to know our projections, our fears, our anxieties. And remembering these very sobering words that what we keep out, what we exile in our psyches, That is ends up controlling us. So hopefully that journey of self-discovery is done in a non-judgmental way, both the way that we look at our own psyche and the way that we look at others' psyche. So that self-discovery is a journey. It's a journey done in trust and friendship. And it's also a journey undertaken in our own faith in the three jewels. So we have communication. Yeah, we're well known in Tri Ratna as the movement that talks a lot. Yeah, we're always talking. There's a shadow side to that. Yeah. There's advantages and there's the underbelly of that. So there's a lot of communication in Tri Ratna. And we have to be careful that that communication doesn't simply, what's the word, emphasise the myths that we have about ourselves. Yeah? We also have confession in Tri Ratna. We also have friendship, a lot of friendship. Everything's based on friendship in Tri Ratna. Not always easy, huge challenge, but we're trying. Friendship allows us to really work on trust. Trust is active, trust is an emotion, trust we put in. Yeah? It's not something we hang around and hope it'll turn up somewhere. We have to put it in, or put our faith on. We've got meditation, we've got ritual, we've got retreats, we've got solitaries. And there's potential in all of those things to get to know ourselves. And I'm sure all of you who've been on retreat will notice how much more alive you feel after a retreat. You feel much more in touch with yourself, much more in touch with others, much more alive to your environment, to what's around you. So what we're also building up in the spiritual community is a sensitivity. And I think that's what Atala this time means when he talks about soul. It's a sensitivity. It's a sort of allowing our longings to be there, allowing ourselves to be moved, to be touched, to get excited about things, to be engaging more and more. And I think allowing our soul to be touched, to be moved, allows a vitality to come into being, allows even a joy to come into being. And recently, in terms of this bringing our psyche together, I was on a retreat for private preceptors in Taraloka in England. And you know, sometimes I think we have quite a naive view of integration, or maybe a sort of, we think, you know, we sort of fit ourselves together in the right sort of way, we'll be okay. And this was quite an eye-opener for me. One of the order members, one of the Dharmacharinis on this retreat, she reported back, or she looked through her notes that she had got. She'd been studying with Subhuti. About six of them had been studying together with Subhuti. And what she was telling us from her notes, or what she could remember of the study, was understanding integration in a much broader way and looking at the ethical aspects of integration. And she said, or what they'd studied, was because of our character and personality, what we bring into this world, there are some things that are programmed in us. We're hardwired, to use that, in a particular way. And we won't make a lot of progress in this life changing those things. Yeah, they're part of our personality, they're part of our character. What we need to do is to get to know those things that are hardwired inside us and to take responsibility for the effect that they have on us and on others. We maybe can't change them, But we need to take responsibility. That's the ethical responsibility we have. And then there's the things we can change. Lots of things we can change in ourselves. And again, it's getting to know what is it that I need to change? What is it that is actually having an effect on the world which is not skillful, which is not wholesome? And we need to change those. And we need to take responsibility for the effect of those things on us, on ourselves and on others. And it's very simple what I'm telling you now, but this was a real eye-opener for me, because I think I also had this idea that, you know, I could change everything in me, and if I just got it right, I'd be integrated. But it's not like that. It's much more complex. And it's something, there's something compassionate to my mind about thinking there are probably programs or hardwiring in me that I bring into this life that I'm not going to be able to change. There's something compassionate and human about that. But I have to get to know them. I can't just say, well, that's the way I am, you know, take me as I am, because that's how I am. I have to get to know that. And I have to get to know the effect of that, both on myself and on others. So there's a huge ethical responsibility there. So the other thing that I wanted to mention is Indra's net, which is a myth that you might have heard about. How am I doing for time? Okay. Indra's net. So, I can't remember, was it Ila? It doesn't matter. Anyway, it was on an order retreat in Spain. So this retreat, a similar retreat to the one that Sri Daya's on. We had a talk from an order member called Dharmanandi. And she talked about Indra's net. And she said that this was a myth not only of the spiritual community, but a myth of the order. And I'll never forget her words, actually, because they really hit home. And she said, if one order member is tugging at the net on one side in, let's say, an unskillful, individualistic, unwholesome way, yeah, then all the order members will feel that tug, yeah, because the net is spread over, in a way, spread over the order. So if anybody's tugging on that net, the rest of the order will feel it. And it was quite an eye-opener, this myth of Indra's net, and, you know, what happens when we're individualistic. I mean, order, all of us know the, I think most of us will have heard of the Avalokiteshvara as the order, the myth of the order, the thousand arms going out to help. But this, I think, is also equally an important myth of Indra's net and tugging on the net. So what does this tugging on the net mean? Well, in the end, the myth of the order is that my choices, the choices I make as an order member, the decisions I make as an order member, as an individual, everything I do has to be in relation to the well-being of the order. That is my reference point. There's no other reference point. There's no, oh, it doesn't matter, I'll just do that, I'll please myself. Whatever I do, whatever decisions I make, is in relation to the well-being of the collective, the well-being of the order. And that is a huge, huge challenge, yeah? And all of us fall very, very far from that ideal, let me tell you. But it's there, and it's sobering. Something else just to put out to you is a quote that I've come across recently. I can't remember actually where I came across this quote. And it's in a way coming at it from different angles. And the quote is, I need to deconstruct myself in order to come into relationship with others. I need to deconstruct myself in order to come into relationship with others. So there's lots to examine there. What does deconstruct mean? Yeah? What does coming into relationship mean? I don't know how it is for you, and I know this is these words are English words, but I find them, again, very exciting. And I'm not often in England, and I don't often talk about my spiritual life in English. It's a funny thing, I usually talk about it in German. And then one day I was in England talking about my spiritual life, and I heard a Dharmacharini friend of mine talk about this coming into relationship. I'd never heard this before. And I was quite taken, it spoke to me. And when she said this word, immediately it created space for me. And I realised that coming into relationship with something means there's another way of looking at my experience. There are other doors, there are other entrances into looking and understanding my experience, other ways of connecting with it. So, and I'm going to use this coming into, I have already used it, and I'm going to keep on using it for the remainder of the talk. So the spiritual community helps us to deconstruct ourselves. It helps us to hang loose to our ego identity, to our ego perception. It's very, very easy for us to feed our own myth about ourselves. We want to control. We want to control our world. We want to sometimes even control what other people think about us. And sometimes we can manipulate things so that others and the world around us feeds this myth back to us. But what we see is, actually, there's a lot of fear and a lot of anxiety there. And we suffer. There's just dukkha. So we can protect and defend ourselves quite a bit. But when we deconstruct ourselves, there's a transparency there. There's a this word I love, defencelessness. Defencelessness. There's flexibility. There's relaxation. Attila talks about noticing, caring. There's a confidence in us. However messy we, and most of us have look pretty messy inside when you get down to it, yeah. But we're happy to be messy. We don't have to be guilty about messy. We don't have to hide from being messy. We can be happily and confidently messy. I know Ratnaguna was here recently, wasn't he? I think he, yeah. And he came from Sweden straight to Germany, and we had an order retreat with him. And he said, Buddhism is relational. Buddhism is relational. And I thought, this is the key to the whole myth about spiritual community as myth. It's relational because, first of all, we get the teachings. We get the Dharma teachings from a teacher. We get them from Bhante Sangharakshita, or you here in the Stockholm Sangha get them from your Dharmacharini and Dharmacharinis, Dharmacharis and Dharmacharinis. So we're relating all the time to somebody for the teachings. And again, Attila talks a lot about needing to be more relational, needing to come into relationship with ourselves, with others, with the world, healing that brokenness, that separation within, healing and bringing together, gathering the shadows, the things we don't own, the things we exile. So when we deconstruct ourselves, we let go and we let the light in. There's more of me in my wholeness, able to meet you in your wholeness and able to meet life in its wholeness. And that deconstructing happens in the playground, because play is very important, in the playground of the spiritual community. So again, I just want to bring, I'm just trying to come at it from different angles. And a while ago I read, I like Tricycle, it's an American Buddhist magazine, I think you might get it in the library. There was a quote from a practitioner called Robert Scharf, and he said, Sangha transcends self-concerns of any individual, especially concerns that arise from placing our inner life at the centre of the universe. So if we place our inner life at the centre of the universe, there's no Sangha. Because there's a tendency simply to narcissism. And we move away, actually, from wanting to have a collective, wanting to share our lives in a collective way. So from another point of view, Subhuti says, when we get in the way, Sangha goes. When we get in the way, Sangha goes. And he talks about how we often work out our place, our role, our importance in Sangha. Or when we hold back from Sangha and we create a group of one. When we feel a bit special, yeah? When we feel a bit exclusive, and it's all about us. So Sangha is not a thing. The spiritual community is not a thing. It's not abstract. It's embodied. There is only embodied experience in the Dharma. So Sangha is something that's embodied. It's something that's experienced. At any moment, we're either building it or we're undermining it. So the myth of spiritual community transcends roles and differences and conflicts. And Subhuti talks about the energy and the vitality when we come together. And in this talk, he had been given some very, very strong feedback. It was quite funny, actually. He got some strong feedback from somebody he had ordained. And somebody, this order member wrote to him and said, Subhuti, I think you need to rejoin the order. And when he got this email, he thought, what do you mean rejoin the order? I gave you the order! And then he realised it was true. He needed to rejoin the, he'd had been through quite a lot of things, yeah, in his, over the years. He needed to rejoin the order. And I think sometimes we need to rejoin the Sangha. Probably we need to rejoin again and again and again. So I think when we find ourselves talking about them and us, yeah, those Sangha members and us, about her and me, him and me, when that sort of polarizing goes on, then at that moment we're identifying ourselves outside of the Sangha and we need to rejoin. We need to open up to the spirit of Sangha. So I'm coming to the end, and I'm just going to try and put again what I've been saying, what I've been trying to communicate, and then we're going to do have another little quote, and I think I might have missed one quote, but it doesn't matter, and then do an exercise, so that. You get a sense of you get a sense for yourselves what I'm trying to do, what I'm trying to say. So the spiritual community is a myth in itself, and we need to revere that myth, revere the Sangha, and engage with that myth to deconstruct ourselves, to heal and mend our brokenness, our separation, our isolation from ourselves and from others, from the world as a living organism. The spiritual community is the playground for that. And the playing is reflected in the roots of Buddhism. So the myths, the rituals, the symbols, that rich tradition that we have in Buddhism. There's something there for everybody. And Tri Ratna is also creating its own myths, its own symbols, its own patterns of meaning as it develops as a movement. So within the spiritual community, we're discovering the true meaning of life, the patterns that allow freedom and creativity, that get us back to life, get us back to really, what is reality? What is reality? And that getting back to life is embodied experience. It's not just a nice idea in my head. So, this is when I'm going to read a little bit again from Aloka. And let's find the part, the bit. Yeah. So when I was reading this again, I remembered the story of the Aniruddhas. Yeah, because the Aniruddhas for me are very much about just not polarizing. Yeah, this non-duality. I'm aware that non-duality means far more than not polarizing, but in terms of relationships, there's a sort of the Aniruddhas are just working together. There's no polarization. And Aloka says, the challenge for humanity is to grasp the weapons of non-duality which open the way to true creativity, free from any potentially restrictive views or systems, which of course cannot really be grasped. Their strength can be tapped via myth and symbol. So I'll read it again, it's long sentences. The challenge for humanity is to grasp the weapons of non-duality, which open the way to true creativity, free from any potentially restrictive views or systems, which of course cannot really be grasped. Their strength can be tapped via myth and symbol. So I think, in a way, the spiritual community is living out those myths and those symbols, and they're living them, and we're living them out both individually and collectively. And I think that's the only way, actually, that we can come into contact with myth and symbol through each other. So When I had written this talk, I thought it's a bit short on the old practice, yeah, on the old practical thing. So I thought I'd give you a little bit of an exercise to do at this point. So I hope nobody will decide to get up and leave. So it's an exercise I've taken straight from Attila's talk, actually. So I thank him for that. Attila talks about myth as understanding and engaging in the ground between where we find ourselves, yeah, our human messiness, and our ideals. And he gives a practical example. He says, imagine a situation in your everyday life. Imagine a situation, perhaps here in the spiritual community, where you've heard yourself saying, you, this person, is doing this to me. Yeah? We all know that, don't we? You are doing this to me. And he says that is the ego projection. It's how the ego sees things. You are doing this to me. You're insulting me. You're hurting me. Yeah? And he talks about it as being single and abstract. And then he says, we bring in the myth. And the myth in Buddhism is, I see my enemy as my guru. Or I see my enemy as a bodhisattva. I think we've all heard that. We've all come across that. So this is the myth that we're trying to practice, bring into being. So we're trying to engage with this myth in a way where there's nothing to defend in ourselves, nothing to protect. I'm going to be open to my shadow. I'm going to be open to what's going on when I say, you are doing this to me. So he says we bring it into relationship. We think of another way of perceiving this other than our ego. And then we say, I am perceiving this as my projection of, and it could be a projection of my fear, projection of being threatened, a projection of my anxiety. So one is this sort of single ego projection. This is what is happening. We engage with the myth and then we see it from another, from a completely different standpoint. We come into relationship with it. I think coming into relationship is allowing this space, or just allowing this space for something else to arise. So he says when we move from the ego perspective, from this single abstract view of the world through our eyes, and we begin to look at what's happening, we begin to care about what's happening, then we can ask ourselves three questions. What meaning does this event, so event is this response I have to the person, what meaning does this event have for my development? Yeah, so in other words, how am I looking at it in a dharmic perspective? What meaning does this event have for my aspiration to serve the world? Very interesting. Yeah. Completely away from the ego. And what meaning does this event have in terms of serving the quality of soul in the world? Which I think is just magnificent. Because the quality of soul in the world, for me, is the inside aspect. So what's going on? Yeah, what's going on when I just see things from my ego perspective? What am I, in a way, taking away from the world when I could be giving to it, when I could be enriching the world, if I saw things from another perspective? So I was really fascinated by those things, by those three questions. And I thought, let's have a go tonight. Let's have a go at just sitting here and thinking of a situation that's happened fairly recently where we've heard ourselves say, he or she or they did this to me. Yeah, I'm sure everybody can think of something. It's such a common, yeah. Somebody's hurt me, somebody's insulted me, somebody's let me down, somebody's betrayed me, yeah. All the sorts of things. So just recall to mind something in the last, I don't know, last 24 hours or the last week. And if you can, if it's possible, try to see what it is there that you're trying to defend, that you're trying to protect. Maybe it's just the sense of trying to protect and defend something, not quite sure what it is yet. So maybe there's something there that you don't often own, that you push away, that you exile, or send into exile. Maybe there's some sort of shadow there that's not so pleasant to look at. So try and create a space within yourself So try and come into relationship. So in a way, it's like you're also holding with metta. I think it's creating that space of metta. So can you turn it around and perceive it as your projection? Can you own it as your projection? Can you see it touching on your fear, on your anxiety, the sense of yourself? So if you've got anything at all there, if there's any sense of anything there, even if it's a little bit vague, what do you think this tells you about your spiritual development? Again, this is all non-judgmental. You're holding with metta. You're not giving yourself a hard time. And when you think about your aspiration to serve the world, what meaning is there, or what response is there in your reflections about your projection? In terms of your aspiration to serve in the world, you know, just trusting yourself that you do want to serve the world, what does this this projection, what is it telling you about that aspiration? Okay, the last one is we're thinking in terms of serving the quality of soul in the world, so the quality of sensitivity in the world, sensitivity to us, to others, to our environment. What's it telling me about that? Is there any insight there for me? So I think ideally, you know, we could spend quite a lot of time just reflecting on this. It just gives you a taste of this coming into relationship with, you know, seeing things with a broader perspective and trusting, actually, we do want to serve the world, trusting that we do have an effect in the world. So, I've actually managed it this time, before time. So thank you very much for your cooperation.